sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear a speech by Dr. Peter Phillips given at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 14, 2010. Peter Phillips is a professor of sociology at Sonoma State University in California. He's director emeritus of Project Censored and co-editor of Project Censored's new Censored 2011, the top 25 censored news stories of the past year. For more information, his website is projectcensored.org. And here he is, Dr. Peter Phillips.
35 years ago, when Project Censored was started, there were, at that time, 50 major media corporations in the United States that dominated the news. Over the years, we're now down to 10. So analysis of how come news stories aren't covered, one of the best was Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman that was done 21 years ago. And they talked about how the corporate media is locked into capitalism, that they're locked into advertisers, bottom line orientation for making money, that they continue to consolidate, they support a strong market economy, and they tend to avoid certain types of stories because of their self-interest. And that was called the propaganda model, kind of a theoretical structural model of media. And that worked pretty good for quite a while. We would use that, particularly in the 90s, early 90s, but since 9/11, we have a whole different understanding of what's going on in corporate media, and it's more along the lines of a deliberate propaganda model of news and information. And we're going to cover some of the things that really lead us to that. I think one of the first issues that really got us thinking that there's something seriously wrong here, it's not just a structural issue, but it's deliberate, was how the ACLU in 2005 had been pushing the U.S. military, the Pentagon, to release autopsy reports of civilians who died in Iraq during the first 2 years of the war. And they had to threaten court. I mean, they had the right under the Freedom of Information Act, but the Pentagon was really dragging their feet. Finally, they got copies of 44 autopsy reports. Now, these autopsy reports were the U.S. military doctors' examinations of the bodies after somebody died while in U.S. custody, civilians. So in October of 2005, they released a press release, and they said, well, of the 44 autopsy reports, 23 of those listed the cause of death as homicide. And these were multiple sites. And not, this wasn't just Abu Ghraib. I mean, this was multiple sites in Afghanistan and Iraq. The conditions of the body clearly indicated, and doctors had verified this, these people were tortured to death. Extensive bruises, contusions, broken bones, strangulation, just really awful stuff. The rest of the bodies, the rest of the autopsy reports, the primary cause of death was heart failure while being tortured. And, you know, these were young people. So this was really, for the first time, absolute proof that we were torturing people to death on a wide scale, not just embarrassing them or having dogs snip at them and that, but really beating and killing people. And ACLU, with their press release, put this out, and AP picked it up. Associated Press, which reaches a billion people in the world, they put this out on their wire service to all 1,700 daily newspapers in the United States, to all 5,000 radio and television news programs across the country. And LexisNexis checks and further examination, we found out that 99.5% of them did not run the story. So LA Times had it on page A4. Seattle paper had it buried inside a larger story in Iraq, and the rest were small Midwest papers that actually covered it. So that meant that 1,600-plus newspaper editors saw that story and decided not to run it. And we don't know why. But they just decided that maybe they thought it would be seen as unpatriotic, or the American people wouldn't believe it, that we were torturing people to death. Whatever the reason, we know that this was a factual decision. So this wasn't just the high levels of MSNBC or Fox or that making a decision. This was right down inside of grassroots media in the U.S. today. And that really kind of set us back a bit. And we started to think about what that means and the degree to which an American empire will go to propagate and push and continue to push global capital power worldwide. We know that in the U.S. prisons, we have 2 million people incarcerated, most for nonviolent offenses, and that we have a new story this year that came from Op-Ed News that talks about torture in prisons, beatings, isolations, imprisonment, torture itself, electric shock, prolonged exposure to heat, shackled prisoners lying for hours in their own cells across the country. That's not how we think of ourselves as a society. We now know that the immigration control people, ICE, they are holding thousands of U.S. residents in unlisted and unmarked subfield offices. This came out of the Nation magazine this year. They admit that they have 186 unmarked subfield offices. Now, these are suburban offices, sometimes commercial spaces that are rented. It could be a room like this where they would pack in hundreds of people and hold them there for days with no facilities, no drinking water, I mean, no beds, just places to house people, to hold them, to lock them up. The goal this year, according to ICE field director, is to deport 400,000 people. That's their goal this year. These are not just criminals. They say they're targeting people who have done crimes, but this is their goal. That's the goal. So you have a network across the country that utilizes local police to identify people, often based on the color of their skin, and then pulling them off the street. In fact, there was this one quote from James Pendergraph, who was executive director of ICE a couple years ago. He said, if you don't have enough evidence to charge somebody criminally, but you think they're illegal, we can make them disappear. Now, the Obama administration has been expanding this controversial 287G program so that local police, and this is kind of the model for what's going on in Arizona. So we're building, we have a criminal justice system. We've got prisons all over. Now we have secret detention centers. And then these people are deported through deportation courts that there's no public access allowed. So if someone's picked up off the street, they don't get to see a lawyer. The family doesn't know where they are. They don't get to make a phone call. They're moved around from place to place and can actually disappear. And that's the level to which the systems we're building in the U.S. operate. Now, Obama's also talking about doing DNA testing on not everybody that's convicted, but everybody who's arrested to build a DNA database on all people mixed in with law enforcement in the country. Now, this on top of the practices that have been going on since 2005 called FALCON, federal and local cops organized nationally, which are nothing other than practices for mass arrests in this country. We have now mass arrests will coordinate 960 agencies, federal, Justice Department, Homeland Security, FBI, Secret Service, IRS, have taken a list of, the first list was 10,000 people supposedly with felony arrest warrants, coordinated with the state police, county sheriff's office, your local SWAT teams, all under one structured, coordinated mechanism of mass arrest. Now, we've done that multiple times. Over 90,000 people as of this year have been arrested in these mass arrest practices. So not only can we make people disappear, but we have a coordinated top-down mechanism for grabbing a whole lot of people really quickly. Those worry us. These are systems of oppression that can impact everybody. The fact that habeas corpus now can be suspended for any person in the United States based upon the decision of the president, the person's an enemy of the state. But you don't have to have done anything. Obama can simply say that those people in conspiracy groups are untrustworthy, and here's their names, and they can be treated just like an illegal immigrant. And except immigrants aren't illegal, they just don't have papers. It's not against the law, technically. And they can be arrested and held without an attorney, without rights of habeas corpus. And that's law today. It's established law. It's all been done under Homeland Security and under the Bush administration, but Obama hasn't changed a thing. So we're moving in this direction where Chris Hedges was interviewing Chomsky last month, and Chomsky's using the fascism word. He's saying that we have a serious problem. They're working more and more like the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 30s. And that this is where the social democrats and the communists had basically disappeared, were killed and murdered. And the magnitude of murder is quite evident. With our invasion of Iraq, there's been three national surveys done on the number of civilian deaths in Iraq since the beginning of the war. Two by Johns Hopkins University, 2003-2006, and then one by Opinion Business Research Group out of Great Britain. Now, these were surveys where they went out, the one in 2007 went out, interviewed 2,400 families in Iraq in 15 of the 18 provinces. They didn't go into the most violent ones. And one of the questions was, has someone in your family died from war violence? And they're able to extrapolate from that data at the 99% accuracy level, the entire deaths in Iraq, and they said at that time, and this was 2007, that there's been 1 million civilian deaths in Iraq because of the war. Now, these aren't deaths because somebody got sick and died. These were war violence deaths. And this is 1 million people in excess of what had been the death rate under Saddam Hussein. Now, the Johns Hopkins study also asked people how they died. And their 2006 survey was quite clear that half of them died either by aerial bombing or U.S. firefights. So we've killed 500,000 people. Our forces have killed 500,000 people in Iraq and displaced 5 million more. That's mass murder. I mean, that is mass killings of people. And you won't find those figures in any newspaper in the country. You won't see those figures in any television program. The million figure was reviewed. The methods were reviewed by MIT. The Nation magazine last January, a year ago January, published the results from the MIT's review. Said, yep, 1 million dead Iraqis. It doesn't get carried out there. It doesn't get talked about. It doesn't get engaged. The level of people that are dying. Instead, what we got a year ago, April, was a press release that came out of AP out of Baghdad that said government sources inside Baghdad say that the number of civilian casualties since at that time, they said 2005, were 87,000. And the total civilian casualties for the war were 110,000. Now, that story ran nationwide last April. They re-released the same story in July. And they re-released the same story again in October. That is deliberate lying. That is deliberate top-down propaganda. That's not just avoidance of a story like the torture stop. This is deliberately misinforming us. Instead, in November of 2008, they had a story, AP put out a story, that hundreds of stray dogs are killed in Baghdad. But we can't find out about the civilian death rates. That's top-down propaganda. That's deliberate. That's the Pentagon. That's the public relations firms that work for the Pentagon and the U.S. government. And this is global. This isn't just the U.S. Our media systems are global. And we have to start thinking globally in terms of our resistance. The Defense Department is the worst polluter on the planet. They have contribute more to global warming, just the Iraq war, than 60% of the rest of the world. Just the Iraq war. Deadly substance, pesticides, defoliants, petroleum, lead, mercury, depleted uranium, one of the worst. And we did the depleted uranium story about 5 years ago, and it was in the top 10. And just after it came out, the Pentagon re-released a story saying depleted uranium wasn't harmful. Yet the birth defects in Fallujah last year were 25%. One out of four kids was born with a birth defect in Iraq. And they're spiraling. And they're showing that this is related to this radioactivity that we're leaving there that's going to be around for 500,000,000 years. It's permanent radiation. In whole swaths of Afghanistan and Iraq and Serbia, for that matter. So we're not only polluting the world, creating more CO2 gases than most of the countries, but the military is completely exempt from any environmental regulations by the U.S. government. They can do whatever they want. We've got 1,000 military bases worldwide. We spend more on weapons and warfare than the rest of the world combined. And we're in partnerships with NATO. So NATO and the U.S., with all these bases, are the protectors of global corporate capitalism. They're the protectors of the World Bank, the neoliberal things, and the shock doctrine process that Naomi Klein writes about. That's the agenda. That's the opposition. Those are the oppressors that we all collectively share. We're going to do a $15 billion buildup in Guam. We don't know this. Massive expansion build up military bases there. At the same time, worldwide, in terms of security, the World Bank now admits that 3 billion people live on less than $2.50 a day. That 44% of those, over a billion, live on less than $1.25 a day. So this means no phone calls, no nutritious food, no vacations, no television, no dental care, no inoculations. That's the structure of inequality. And that structure is maintained by the global military empire and corporate capitalism worldwide. And I'm not saying capitalism negatively. I'm talking about the big, huge corporate entities that are larger than most nations. And they're the ones that benefit, rob, and create this kind of poverty. As we understand that, and we understand that they're a piece of that, that this empire is a repression that addresses all of us. So these post 9/11 top-down decisions, military empire, are working very closely with newly expanding public relation groups that are feeding us this propaganda. There's three major groups that, since 2001, have been publicly merging. The largest is Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group. These firms employ 163,000 people in 170 countries. They create the news. They will actually manufacture news or write up stories with a spin, depending on who's paying them. So this is a lot of the ones that we knew from before. Young and Rubicon, Burston Marsteller, Ogilvy and Mather, Worldwide, Helen Nolan. Helen Nolan was the one that brought us, during the first Iraq war, the young woman before Congress named Nayira, who testified how she was a nurse in the Kuwaiti hospital, and she watched the Iraqi soldiers come in and dump the babies out of the incubators on the cold floor to die and steal the incubators and take them back to Baghdad. And she said this with tears flowing down her face in front of Congress and television, and we were all outraged and, oh, this is terrible, and it wasn't true. It was a choreographed. She is trained. She was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. She was trained by Helen Nolan with the full knowledge of the White House. So that kind of deliberate lying, that's what we're up against. It's the Rendon Group creating the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein after the invasion. It's the Jessica Lidge story, the young private who was injured in the hospital. And they Rendon gets them to delay going to get her because they simply, the hospital called, hey, we got one of your soldiers, come get her. And they had to have the special forces going in and follow that on national TV. So we get this big story about Jessica Lynch. The same day, the rest of the world is finding out that we shelled the Palestine Hotel and killed journalists there. The tanks are rolling into Baghdad. We bombed Al Jazeera and killed one of their journalists. But we get Jessica Lynch. So there's a deliberate diversion of news stories or taking things out of the mix. Where's the Gulf oil thing now? Do you find it on like page 8? And they're saying it's anywhere between 5,000 or 200,000. And the magnitude's incredible and they can't fix it. And the BP is going to say, oh, well, we're going to cover it all. It could be $1 trillion, according to Wayne Mason. BP isn't even worth that much. So this disaster that's going on right now is devastating. They're doing everything they can to kind of protect capital globally in that respect. So we find is that these big PR firms and the big media groups are working hand in hand to create the news top down. And on the boards of directors are all of these big corporations, the banks, the military industrial companies, the Carlyle Group, Bechtel, Boeing, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, all have people on the boards of directors of the biggest media groups in this country. And they're interlocked worldwide. So there is this rift between reality reporting, and it's peaking. There's no longer just a credibility gap, but there's this terminology we've been using for 3 years now, this truth emergency. And it's not only keeping things concealed, but deliberately putting out misinformation. Deliberate countering as we come up with news and information. We're saying a million dead Iraqis, all of these things. Deliberately countering that. DU is not harmful to you, things like that. So it does create a reality that means that you can't tell what's real on television. It's like going to Disneyland. You know you're really there and you know it's not real. So that's this term, hyper-reality. And it's emotional and it's titillating and it's gossipy and you kind of can get excited about the stuff that's going on. There's lots of visual images and you can be scared or whatever. So you end up in this kind of excited delirium, but you don't know anything about what's going on or what the powerful are doing. We have to build this truth movement from the bottom up. And it's got to be bigger than just our single issues, whether it's 9/11 or Israel-Palestine or propaganda or abortion or whatever side on any single issue that you're concerned about. Truth has to be much bigger than that. We have to address it. We can lay out the truth so we have access to information. We can find these things. Part of that, we're really hoping, we've been working really hard getting other universities engaged in the kind of work that we do. We have 30 affiliate universities with Project Censored worldwide. We're saying we're internationalizing. And what students will do in a classroom is they'll find an independent news story that they're interested in. They'll research it. They'll take it to a faculty member on campus who's an expert in that field. And then they'll validate that story and they'll summarize it and post it on our website as a validated news story, which becomes a candidate for one of our top 25 for the year. And we're getting input now from Spain, Germany, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Ecuador, and all over the country, Canada, and the U.S. And we think that that'll grow. So we think that universities are a place where research, where fact-finding is done. And they're as much interested in that. The university is as diverse as any other population. There's people that, you know, say, how could you possibly talk about 9/11? Well, we talk about it because we've looked at factual information, and we think it's really true. We know that Building 7 falling down in 6.5 seconds is a problem. We know that Bush, the Bin Laden family, being flown out of the country is a problem. That Bush staying at the school in Florida for 20 minutes after they knew what was going on, or they probably knew before, is a problem. Prior history of the hijackers linked to U.S. intelligence agencies is a problem. Pre-warnings, Abel Danger, Steve Jones, the research from Copenhagen on the nanothermite, all of these are very serious issues. And we are, again, in our 2011 book, going to cover some of the... We have a story. It'll be in the top 25. It's called Increased Tensions with Unresolved 9/11 Issues. We get right in there with Richard Gage, David Ray Griffin, Cass Sunstein, and we just pull it together and say, hey, there's still a lot of tension going on around these issues, and these are factual stories that we think are very important. Deep politics is more than, I mean, there's a couple sides of this. Now, there's certainly the side of looking at the power structures, of examining the global dominance group, which we did a couple of years ago. We put together a list of the 263 people inside of the military-industrial core that were pushing global domination of the world. That chapter is actually in David Ray Griffin's Peter Dale Scott's book on intellectuals speak out. And it's our attempt to put some parameters on who they are when we start saying they did this and they did that. We got to know who they are. That's part of what deep politics is about. We have to know more about Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Halliburton, SAIC, Boeing Group, the Carlyle Group, but also the think tanks that they work with. PNAC, the Hoover Institute, American Enterprise, Hudson Institute, Heritage Foundation. You know, these are the planners, networks of people that are engaging. And let's not forget the Trilateral Commission, because most of Obama's administration is straight out of the Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. They're like two wings of the global elite. And the more we can study that, the more we can identify who these players are and how they're involved and how they're involved with Congress. And we can show that 151 members of Congress are invested one of the top defense contractors. So they, you know, massively interlocked. And that $3.2 billion was spent lobbying Congress in 2008. That's $32,000 per day per member of Congress. And if you go there, maybe you can get to see your congressperson, but you're not certainly going to be spending $32,000 to do it. And that's corporate money. Power money, top-down, control. And we know that 40% of the people in the country question 9/11, and there's a fear. The more we get labeled as conspiracy theorists, as crazy nuts, as that emerges, is an indication that, hey, we're on the right track. But there's a cost that goes with that. The state crimes against democracy piece that Mickey and I wrote, part of it was we were looking at the work by Professor Lance DeHaven Smith from Florida State University, who's part of a public administration network. And these public administrators, these people that study administrations and government processes and that, they've come up with this concept called SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy, and that there are a number of proven crimes against democracy since World War II. McCarthyism's fabrication of communist infiltration, certainly the Gulf Tonkin Resolution, the burglary of Daniel Ellsberg's office to discredit him, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, the 2000 election felon disenfranchised process, fixing the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. Those were lies. Those were deliberate things, and we know it. It's true. There's evidence documenting all of this. Now, other suspected SCADs that they write about, of course, is the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald, the shooting of George Wallace, the October surprise after the Carter administration, anthrax mailing to Daschle and Leahy, Martin Luther King's assassination, collapse of Building 7. These are SCADs that there's a lot of evidence that there's a real problem here, that there's some government crimes or power structure crimes, and it may not always be government because the interlocking of corporations and government is quite intense at the highest levels. It's revolving doors. So whether it's special ops out of Lockheed Martin or special ops out of the CIA, it's still the same power structure. The term conspiracy theory is used to denigrate and discredit inquiry into state crimes against democracy. It's been used for a long time. So labeling a SCAD as a conspiracy theory is an effective method of preventing ongoing investigations from being reported in the media or anywhere else. And psychologist Lori Manuel addresses the psychological advantage that the SCAD actors hold, because research shows that people are less willing to examine information that disputes rather than confirms their beliefs. A million dead Iraqis, well, it couldn't be that many, but it is. And so this is what Steve Hoffman calls, there must be a reason in his justification, a cognitive theory known as motivated reasoning, We tend to want to reason with what we kind of know and are motivated and believe in, what our values are, that sort of thing. And so when we get hit upside the head with something that just like contradicts it, we just want to ignore it. And this is psychological, but the actors that do these things know that. So they're very careful to make sure that they continue to say, well, that person's crazy. Or Stephen Jones is discredited, or David Ray Griffin doesn't know what he's talking about, or just however they label, they'll identify us individually and do that. So we covered in this piece the thermite material at the World Trade Center, the research from the academic journal Open Chemistry, where the thermite has now been shown to be in the dust from the World Trade Center. We covered that in this piece. And we documented this. We wrote a piece for the op-ed service we had been writing for, I'd been writing for the last 6 years, called Minuteman Media. And we'd write, I'd probably written 60 op-eds for him. Except Minuteman Media was assumed and taken over by Institute for Policy Studies in Washington 6 months ago. Now, I like the Institute of Policy. They do a lot of good work. But when we submitted this op-ed, they flat said, we're not going to cover that topic. And they said, it's just unacceptable. And then they couching like, well, we don't like your writing style and stuff like that. You know, they kind of backed off saying, no, they were very topical. They said, we are not, she told me very directly, I'm not going to name names here, I'm just going to say, we were told very definitely that we don't like those truthers. They're obnoxious. They're interfering with the peace movement. Now, but listen here, now, we're laughing, but there's some images here that we have to deal with. And so our piece was censored. And so last week, it was time to send another one in, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to send in a new one. And I was written back and said, no, thank you. So we've been censored permanently from that network. When we write something, we put it up on our site. It's on 50 websites in 2 days. So millions of people see it. But that's part of the difficulty that we're faced with, particularly when we stick with a single issue. And we're adamant about our 9/11 issue, or adamant about whatever it is that we're dealing with, when the problem is much, much larger. All the people with the issues, truth emergency issues, have a common oppressor, this military-industrial media complex using U.S. military and NATO to dominate the world, and these huge mega corporations that are in all our pockets and they're everywhere and they're responsible for starvation and death and war. That's a much bigger thing. So talking about going beyond just 9/11, and I don't say just 9/11 because we've certainly written about it, covered it, and addressed the factual things as university professors that we see are important without speculating who did what without the information. But we need to go beyond that and think in ways that we can involve each other, people that we disagree with fundamentally on some certain issue, single issues, or who may disagree with us, but can understand the common oppression. So one of the places we might want to start to think about looking is, what do we share in common? And what I start almost all my classes with is have my students read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it's 60 years old now, more than 60. A whole lot of people in San Francisco back in 1948 worked hard on this, and around the world, the UN, to come up with a list from nations all over. Almost all nations have now signed on to this, that says that human rights are part of what a human being is. Everyone has a right to life, liberty, and security of person. No person can be subject to torture or cruel or inhumane treatment. Everyone has a right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. No one shall be subject to arbitrary interference with the privacy, family, or home, their correspondence, their honor, their reputation. Everyone has a right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of their state. Everyone has a right to a nationality. Everyone has a right to own property in association with others. Everyone has a right to change their religion, belief, or freedom and be public about it. Everyone has a right to freedom of peaceably assemble and association. I mean, these are pretty basic things. I don't ever get any disagreement from my college classes. Everyone has a right to work. Everyone has a right to rest and leisure. Everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being of himself and herself, including food and clothing, housing, medical care. There's nothing wrong with this. This is some commonality. The oppressed, and that's 90% of us, where our wages have been going down for 35 years. It's the 3 billion who are starving in the world that have nothing. These are the commonalities of who we are. And finding these commonalities, engaging in these commonalities and these beliefs, sharing these, no matter what our single issues are, is absolutely vital. If we're going to go into deep politics, we have to go deep into ourselves and not only address the power elite and who they are, but look inside of ourselves deeply and inside of others deeply to build relationships, to build understandings of who the oppressors are and what we share in common. So we can't just call people gatekeepers because they won't talk about 9/11 when Chomsky has done so much to address the powerful in the world. We can't just say, well, Amy Goodman won't cover this when she's done so much to bring many of these issues forward. So just speaking here in terms of this deep politics, this is our responsibility as activists to be as open as possible, to find some commonalities, to reach out and to make some changes in the world, not giving up on what we believe, but finding truth and honesty in the others and some working points that we can do together.
That was Dr. Peter Phillips of ProjectCensored.org, given on May 14th, 2010, at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.